Hello there. Today is Thursday, June 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump prepares to head to the G7 summit as allies are angered over trade tariffs.
There are disagreements. He's sticking to his guns, and he's going to talk to them.
Last-minute preparations continue with less than a week to go for a summit between Trump and North Korea's leader. Also ahead, a classic American movie icon has died. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said Wednesday it's too early to call the tariffs imposed by the Trump administration's dispute a trade war, and contended that the U.S. is justified in demanding fair and reciprocal trade with its partners. Speaking to reporters in Brussels, Mattis said economic disputes with allies were not expected to damage military and security relations.
Right now, I don't see that, and I think it's still premature to call it a trade war.
But the European Union says it will begin imposing a new set of tariffs against U.S. imports beginning in July in response to the new U.S. import duties on EU steel and aluminum. European Commission Vice President Mauro Sefcovic announced the new tariffs Wednesday at a news conference in Brussels. He was quoted as saying, quote, "It is a measured and proportionate response to the unilateral and illegal decision taken by the U.S. to impose tariffs on the European steel and aluminum exports, which we regret." The EU has drawn up a wide list of products that will be subject to the new import duties, including denim jeans, motorcycles, and whiskey, which are worth just over $3 billion. The new tariffs are in retaliation to President Trump's recent decision to place a 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum imports. The president is expected to have one-on-one talks with world leaders of the G7 nations in Quebec Friday and Saturday. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Wednesday said he'll have a very, very frank exchange with Mr. Trump. Joining us now to discuss all of it is George Mason University professor Robert Deitz, who's also a former special counsel of the National Security Agency. So are we on the verge of a trade war?
First of all, it's hard to know exactly what a trade war is. The Great Depression was triggered in part by the so-called Smoot-Hawley tariffs, if I'm remembering the name correctly. I know the Smoot part's right. In which we, prior to the understanding of Keynesian economics, there was this notion that we always had to, you know, sell exactly what we bought. I mean, you know, that there had to be an even swap. And so we were in a deficit situation. We put on huge tariffs. Europe countered, and all of a sudden, you know, the trade drops, and we found ourselves in the Great Depression. Look, I'm simplifying it, of course. But the fact is that nations around the world count on trade. And the big dog, like the U.S., can disrupt those patterns and cause enormous harm, you know, not just to other countries, but, of course, to ourselves.
A lot of pushback for that, particularly from the Prime Minister of Canada, who said, you know, you can't be serious that Canada is a national security threat. Is using national security a viable reason?
No.
To issue these tariffs? Is national security legitimate? A legitimate reason?
Under various international trade agreements, nations are obligated not to discriminate against trade from other nations. But there, of course, had to be loopholes, and the principal loophole is national security. For example, if we're purchasing new tanks, we do not have an obligation to import tank parts or even whole tanks from foreign countries. So there is this national security exception. But the way that our president is using it is not legitimate, no.
I understand there are some senators that are looking at introducing a bill requiring congressional approval on national security tariffs. I know the president has been urging them not to continue with that, but it sounds like even some members of his own party now are pretty concerned about these tariffs with our closest allies, like Canada, like Mexico, like France and Germany and Britain.
They should be. It's ironic that the Republicans, of course, have always been the party of free trade. And having their president use tariffs as a weapon is just antithetical. One would have expected that much more from a Democratic president than a Republican one. So I can see why they're concerned, and their constituents are going to be concerned. I would think, number one, the American farmer has got to be really, really concerned. American agriculture is extremely efficient, and a lot of our exports actually are in the agricultural area. So yeah, this is a threat, and I can understand why Republicans are concerned about it.
Do you think this has the ability to actually really backfire and do damage to the American economy?
Of course it does. The problem, however, is figuring out how serious the president is. As we know from the dealings with North Korea, the tariff issues with China, the president zigs and zags, and it's very hard to see, you know, what is the strategy here? What direction is he taking? And so it makes it difficult Well, first of all, it makes it difficult to think about, but also makes it difficult to address.
What about the whole issue of national security in and of itself? If you use that term for so many different reasons, I know the president, this administration has used it for making the case for other policies like immigration. Does that threaten to weaken our ability to reach out to our allies for help when there is a national security threat?
Yes, I suppose so. But to me, the biggest concern is that when you misuse language enough, the language becomes meaningless. And so to call everything a national security threat ends up saying that nothing's a national security threat.
And then we have the upcoming G7 summit, which happens to be coming up Friday in Canada, of all places.
Yes.
In the midst of all these tariff disputes, it sounds to me like the president's going to be kind of walking into the line of fire there with all of these other leaders very upset and angry over this.
Yes, I think that's right. And that doesn't do us good, because we need our allies for things, by the way, having nothing to do with national security per se. We need our allies to be supportive of issues such as international trade, dealing with Russia, again, not necessarily in a military way. And the G7 doesn't need these kinds of stress issues. It would not shock me, by the way, if the president walks back some of this tariff stuff, as he did with China.
All right. That's George Mason University professor Robert Deitz, also former special counsel of the National Security Agency. President Trump does sit down next week with North Korea's dictator, but he'll face perhaps an even tougher crowd before that, the key American allies. And Trump will apparently be sticking to his guns at the upcoming Group of Seven summit, as we just talked about, despite criticism of his trade policies from allies. One of his key economic advisors told reporters, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The president heads Friday to the G7 summit in Canada, where he'll likely get a cold reception, with his new tariffs angering allies and increasing America's isolation. His top economist says they're simply disagreements.
Much like a family quarrel.
But even as Larry Kudlow said, he's optimistic those differences can be worked out. Two people familiar with the president's thinking say he's complaining about having to show up in Quebec, particularly since it's just before the North Korea summit. The White House is not signaling any change in plans.
The president wants to go on a trip.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A New Mexico Democrat is poised to become the first Native American congresswoman. U.S. weighs deep cuts to special operations forces in Africa. Iran stands its ground on nuclear inspections as France warns of a red line. And the tiny country of Singapore prepares for the Trump-Kim frenzy. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. You're listening to International Edition. As President Trump does prepare for next week's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the U.S. Congress is asserting its right to review and potentially reject any nuclear deal that emerges from the historic encounter. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has this report.
the much-anticipated Trump-Kim summit bringing expressions of hope on Capitol Hill.
I'm very pleased to see that we're moving forward with diplomacy.
This thing can be solved. It really can be.
But any accord hammered out at the Singapore summit will have to satisfy lawmakers in Washington.
You have to bring it to Congress, and Congress has a period of time under which to review it and disapprove of it. But if Congress doesn't disapprove of it, it can go forward.
Specifically, lawmakers say Congress will have to approve the sanctions relief Pyongyang is seeking and will not do so absent strict conditions.
There can be no sanctions relief for North Korea unless the regime makes significant progress toward completely, verifiably, and irreversibly dismantling all of its nuclear, chemical, biological, and radiological weapons programs.
North Korea must understand that even if China eases the pressure, we in Congress are ready to step in to tighten the screws. Because without sufficient pressure, we can expect and must prepare for the old Kim family playbook.
Senators of both political parties say North Korea has repeatedly negotiated in bad faith and cheated on past accords.
The history's been just awful. We've been taken to the cleaners, not just once on this, where we started giving stuff, and then at the end of the day, they pulled the carpet out from under us. That is not going to happen again.
Trump has repeatedly stressed the summit may or may not produce an accord. Experts warn risks abound.
A summit is not a strategy, and a summit without a strategy is dangerous. The United States needs to have clear focus on our objectives in this negotiation and must stay closely aligned with Congress and with our allies in achieving these objectives.
The eyes of the world will be on Singapore next week, including those of skeptical U.S. lawmakers. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Facebook is drawing fresh criticism from U.S. lawmakers following revelations that it allowed Chinese smartphone makers to have access to user data. And that included one deemed a national security threat, the world's largest social media network confirming this week that China-based Huawei, which has been banned by the U.S. military and a lightning rod for cyber espionage concerns, was among device makers authorized to see user data. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Cedric Layton, retired Air Force intelligence officer and currently a crisis management consultant, if this is really about Facebook trying to penetrate the Chinese market.
Not really, because Facebook itself has been banned in China since 2009. So the Chinese have their own version of Facebook, actually several versions, that they use for social media purposes, and they don't normally allow their people to get on Western social media platforms. So this is more about actually allowing devices that are manufactured in China to have the right user interfaces that will allow people in the West or in other countries to access Facebook from those platforms.
So U.S. lawmakers are expressing alarm that Chinese firms are being given access to user data at Facebook at a time when officials are trying to block their access to the U.S. market over national security concerns. What is the significance of this?
It's usually significant because since everything is migrating to different platforms, you're seeing a lot of different elements here in play. What you're looking at is the data itself. The data itself is really the gold of our time. It's basically the type of data that you have and what you can do with that data that can allow you not only to sell things to people, but potentially to manipulate them either commercially to buy certain products or politically to vote for certain candidates. And so the risk is very great that data that is culled from these social networks is put to use in a way that, first of all, is not intended, but secondly, can actually change people's perceptions that they have of different events. It can potentially change the outcome of elections, and it can potentially change the outcome of commercial deals. So there are a lot of different aspects to this that that really are necessary to look at from the standpoint of security as well as untoward influence.
Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts tweeted that Mark Zuckerberg, the founder, of course, and CEO of Facebook, needs to return to Congress and testify why Facebook shared Americans' private information with questionable Chinese companies. Our privacy and national security, he said, cannot be the cost of doing business.
Senator Markey is absolutely right about this, because what we're doing here is we have companies like Facebook, Twitter, and others who are using the data that they have in order to gain access to different elements of the marketplace, and they also want to sell that data to commercial providers. What they're not thinking about is the intelligence value that this data has. And the Chinese are absolutely keen on developing the intelligence aspects associated with this data. That's why China has the largest supercomputers in the world right now. And that is something that is used not only for commercial purposes, but also specifically for intelligence purposes, data collection, data collation, all those kinds of things that intelligence agencies need in order to fine-tune their efforts.
Of course, we know Zuckerberg was questioned in Congress about the taking of personal data of some nearly 90 million Facebook users by a UK-based consultancy called Cambridge Analytica with regard to the presidential campaign. This was a serious matter.
It was absolutely a serious matter, because what data that Cambridge Analytica accessed on Facebook was used, based on the testimony that we've seen and other evidence that we've seen, was used to change the election, or at least in an effort to change the election. And while the actual results of that effort are not completely known yet, it is pretty clear that public perceptions were altered, and that meant that the outcome of the election was at least something that is called into question. As people's perceptions change, their votes may change, and that's the big danger here. The types of information that are now accessible not only to social media platforms like Facebook, but to everyone who accesses the data that those social media platforms have, that becomes the key ingredient. And I think Facebook and others are very naive in their approach to this. They don't look at this from an intelligence standpoint. They look at it from a data collection standpoint and a commercial standpoint. And that is a very incomplete way of looking at things.
An attorney who works on technology privacy issues said that Facebook's sharing of user data with China phone maker Huawei increases the ability of China to launch damaging cyber attacks on the United States.
That's absolutely true. What they can do with this kind of data is actually go into the social media data that they collected and target very specific people. They can target them with phishing campaigns, phishing in the sense of phishing word. And what that means is they can send targeted emails to those individuals, and those individuals, if they think they recognize the sender of that email, may click on the link, and that would be a simple way of attacking them and spreading viruses throughout the system that they have, the networks that they have. So this kind of an action is absolutely a gold mine for not only intelligence agencies, but the cyber weapons arms of different countries, and China is at the forefront of the cyber arms race right now.
All right, that's Cedric Layton, crisis management consultant, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters. The 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
VOA's International Edition continues. In a world where we hear more and more terms like fake news and alternative facts, it can be hard to determine what the truth really is. A timely study that looks at the diminishing role of facts and analysis in American public life has come out by the RAND Corporation, exploring the issue, and it's called Truth Decay, and it may not be a new phenomenon. Joining us now to talk more about it is one of the authors of the study, RAND political scientist Jennifer Kavanaugh. Jennifer, thank you for being with us. So first off, what exactly is truth decay?
Truth decay is the term that we at RAND are using to describe the diminishing role that facts, data, and analysis appear to be playing in our political and civil discourse. And the goal of the report and the project was to try to develop a definition for truth decay to understand what it is we're talking about, to identify the causes and the consequences, and to map out a research agenda or a plan for studying and ultimately addressing this challenge. The way that we defined truth decay was as comprising four specific trends. The first is increasing disagreement about basic facts. The second is a blurring of the line between fact and opinion. Third, an increasing relative volume of opinion compared to fact. And finally, declining trust in key institutions like the government and the media that used to be looked to as sources of factual information.
And so that's what you were looking at and looking for and how you're defining it. What did you find?
Well, I think that we found considerable evidence of each of these four trends in the current period. We don't have good systematic empirical data like we'd like to have to be able to track these trends, such as the amount of disinformation that existed 20 years ago compared to today. The only exception is the area of trust in institutions where we do have good time series data. But we do find significant repeated qualitative evidence and examples of these four trends. So, for example, in the area of increasing disagreement about basic facts and analytical interpretations of data, an example would be the debate over the safety of vaccines. So this is a case where you have an increasing body of evidence that suggests and confirms that vaccines are safe, and yet an increasing number of people who are skeptical and decline to vaccinate their children. So that's just one example. We see blurring of the line between fact and opinion on social media, on cable news. These are places where the amount of space and time devoted to coverage of news and policy and current events has really increased dramatically. But the amount of facts covered in that increased space hasn't really changed from what it was before. So a real explosion in the amount of opinion and commentary that's available. And then, as I mentioned before, you do see declining trust, and that's pretty clear from public opinion data.
And did the study look at why this is happening and what's contributing to it?
Yeah, we did. We identified a number of specific drivers. Some of them are new, and some of them are things that have always existed. The first that we started with was just cognitive biases. There have always been characteristics of human information processing that make us more likely to reject facts and data when they don't conform to our previous existing beliefs or opinions. We're also heavily influenced by our friends and family and by emotional experiences rather than hard facts and data. And that's not new. But I think the changes that we've seen in the information environment over the past 15 years have been really dramatic, and that plays a big role in this. And so here we're talking about the increase in the speed and volume of information that's available. We're also talking about the role that social media and the internet play in providing both a tool to access information, which is a good thing, but also a tool for those intending to spread disinformation to do so really effectively and at a much larger scale. And we're also talking about the role that filters and algorithms play in skewing or shaping the information that each individual that reads, sees, or watches on TV. A third factor that's really driving this, we think, is this gap between the challenges of the new information environment and the skills that schools are currently providing to students. So as we've seen these dramatic changes in the information system, schools are struggling to keep up. And that's partly a result of the fact that technology changes quickly and institutions like schools change slowly. But the result of this gap is that students are very susceptible. Young people are very susceptible to truth decay, as are older people who weren't trained in schools to have these skills. And the skills that we're talking about are the ability to distinguish a good source from a bad source, to synthesize a complex opinion from multiple different sources, to really evaluate bias and understand what is an objective fact and what is opinion, especially when they're presented in an intermingled way. And finally, polarization. And here we're talking not just about political polarization, which we know is at very high levels currently, but also social and demographic polarization and the extent to which these different types of polarization are reinforcing, creating a fragmented society that makes it really easy for competing narratives to thrive.
So you did mention polarization, which we all can see happening.
So our approach to this was to understanding truth decay as a systemic phenomenon. And one of the first things we did was to look back in time to see whether or not we've experienced anything like this before in U.S. history. And we found periods that do seem analogous to today in many ways. They're not exactly the same, but things like the 1880s to 1890s have many of the characteristics that we see today with yellow journalism, which presented sensationalized stories and blurred the line between fact and opinion. You see periods like the 60s and 70s where you have declining trust in institutions. So I do think that while the current period is distinct because of in part, the dramatic changes we've seen in the information environment and also because of the extent of polarization which we're experiencing now. So we see this as a phenomenon that's emerging as a confluence of these different trends. We didn't find that it was directly linked to any individual political party or any individual politician or even political event, but rather something that's emerged gradually over the past 15 to 20 years. And so in that sense, we see the current political environment certainly as an example of this phenomenon, but we also see similar examples in previous administrations.
All right, that's RAND political scientist and author of the study Truth Decay, Jennifer Cavanaugh.
We represent the Lollipop Guild, the Lollipop.
The last munchkin has died. Actor Jerry Marin was the last survivor of the group of little people known as munchkins who greeted Judy Garland's Dorothy when she landed in Munchkinland in the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz. He died on May 24th in a San Diego nursing home, but news of his death only became known on Wednesday. Marin immortalized himself as a member of the Lollipop Guild when he sang, shuffled his feet, and presented Dorothy with a lollipop, a flat, rounded candy on the end of a long stick. Marin was 98 years old. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 8th, much of the world observes United Nations World Oceans Day. The idea is to remind people how important the world's oceans are to all life on Earth, to celebrate their beauty, and to bring attention to the impact human activity has on the oceans. This year, the theme is preventing plastic pollution and encouraging solutions for a healthy ocean. The world's oceans cover nearly three-fourths of the Earth's surface and contain 97% of our planet's water. They produce over half of our oxygen, help regulate our climate, absorb carbon dioxide, and support the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Nearly half of all species on Earth depend on the oceans for survival, and for many of the rest, including for people, the oceans improve the quality of life. The oceans are also indispensable to the world's economy because they are key to transportation and recreation. And inasmuch as over 95% of the underwater realm remains unexplored, it is nearly a certainty that their depths may hold the cure to many a disease, the resolution to many a problem. And yet, as much as 40% of the world's oceans are heavily affected by human activities that result in pollution, overfishing, and loss of coastal habitats. Of particular concern is plastic debris. Some of it comes from ships that ply our rivers, lakes, and seas, and eventually makes its way into the ocean. But about 8 million metric tons of plastic waste washes off land into the ocean each year. Once there, it begins to break down until it turns into small fragments known as microplastics. Plastics are a serious threat because they degrade very slowly, entangle sea creatures, damage habitats like coral reefs, and are ingested by marine animals. Researchers have documented impacts of plastic on over 650 different marine species, including sea turtles, seals, whales, dolphins, porpoises, seabirds, and fish. On World Oceans Day, we must remember that the health and safety of our oceans is our collective responsibility, one that we cannot afford to neglect. Only through good stewardship can we safeguard the health of our oceans and ensure that the oceans continue to meet the needs of future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.